Welcome back to Weekly with WIC. And today we're having a community conversation. In this ever-evolving world of tier changes and mandate changes, we're here to unpack some questions that community members have. And with this, there may not be a firm agreement in our science, in the philosophy of our opinions, but the common ground is our love for the community. So we can have kind conversations, and because of that, we'll help learn, we'll help unpack, and hear different perspectives, and we'll do that for the greater good of the community. And while we may not all walk away in agreement, unification is the goal. So Love Local is a weekly podcast to help our community stay informed and as low as possible in the tier system so that we can keep our kids in school and our local businesses open. With us today, we have Sean Greer, Heidi Mendenhall, and Courtney Abbasi. Thank you so much, ladies, today for your time, your thoughtfulness, and willingness to be here for this community conversation. The format is simple. We're here to have a conversation about questions you have, or maybe even the networks that you have that may have questions. And thank you to Dr. WIC for answering and addressing these. Each participant will introduce themselves, then address their three questions. So let's get started with Heidi.
Hi, thank you. I'm really, really honored to be here. My name is Heidi Mendenhall. I grew up in Tehama as Heidi Bortfeld, and so I am rooted in this county, and I think that's really the role that I bring everywhere, is that I am proud to be Tehama County. I am also the executive director of First Five Tehama, and so with that brings a lens of all things children and family, and probably most importantly, I am the mom of a two-year-old and a six-year-old, and so I have been on this journey with everybody else trying to figure out what school, home, life looks like. So I have three questions, and I'm super excited to have this conversation with you. And these three questions are really, as you'll see, are kind of grounded in children and family, and also in just increasing our understanding, because as I have conversations with my inner circles and my close friends and family, or even healthcare providers, it seems like the more information we have, the more clear things are, the more that we are all comfortable with everything. Thanks. Okay, first question. I am so excited my kiddo is back at school. She's in first grade and she has finished her second week of full school. And we just got some updated guidelines on the type of symptoms that we're watching out for and looking at how long or what options children have to come back. For example, do they need a doctor's note or a negative test from COVID? And I know that there are at least two other school districts that released similar updated information. And in the sake of simplicity and clarity, can you just dig into that for us and describe it a little bit?
Sure. First of all, I think it's important for the audience to know that when we first opened the schools, and our first school that was opened was in early August, we set guidelines based on what we saw from national groups as well as state groups. Those guidelines included symptoms, when classes should be closed, how long we should keep children out. The most conservative guidelines were that if anyone was positive within a classroom, we would basically quarantine the whole classroom because we couldn't guarantee that social distancing had been done, things like that. As time's gone on, we've seen that change. We've seen that the children in kindergarten, the children in preschool even, and certainly the children in elementary school wear their masks. They're doing what they're supposed to. They're much easier to train than the adults. And because of that, we've actually seen very few incidents within the schools. So what we did is we went back and we focused on those guidelines. We saw what worked and what didn't work. And those guidelines were too confusing for most people, so we simplified them. We did not want children to be excluded simply because they had symptoms that may be consistent with a cold. So we made things a little bit more specific. We also changed the timelines. And what we said was is that if a child had COVID-like symptoms, but no exposure to anybody with COVID, then that individual could basically be out for 24 hours, a maximum of 3 days, depending on what it was. if they were tested, got the results back quickly, the test was negative, they could come right back to school.
Okay.
For those individuals who were exposed to somebody that was COVID and have COVID symptoms, that's a totally different story. But what we didn't want to do is keep having these kids go out of school, you know, 14-day quarantine for this, 14-day quarantine because of this exposure, and pretty soon they would have no school experience. And it's all worked. We've seen it work now in all the schools. So, I mean, again, that's why we simplified it. And we did it also so that the lay person can understand it. Because at many of the schools, the person who's making the decision is not the school nurse, but it's a lay person. And what we've asked is all the schools to have somebody at their school who's done our contact tracing program so that they could learn from the experience. Because after you've been through a few scenarios, then you know how to apply the guidance. Otherwise, if you just blindly apply the guidance, we've seen it being applied inappropriately. And so it's meant more time out for the kids. So that's why we updated that. Now, those guidelines actually are in conjunction with the public health department from San Francisco and many other public health departments. So we're all learning from this. And our goal has always been to keep our children in school. Because to be honest with you, we found that's much safer for them to be in school than for them to be at home and be out in the community.
Safer from a public health transmission perspective as well as other perspectives?
Correct.
That is really, really helpful, and that actually really helps me as a parent, but also I think in being able to communicate with other families around the two distinctions. And I think it can feel as though there's two sets of rules, but there's really not. It's all about understanding what you were going in there with, the specifics about your case that you started with, and then you just fall into categories.
Correct. And that's been the problem before, is people think this is just a broad stroke, but it's an individual decision on each case, and we're trying to narrow it down as much as possible, again, to minimize absenteeism and school disruption.
So you mentioned that we actually are doing really good in our schools, which I think is a huge testament to all of the long nights and weekends that everybody has put in. We're also, to my knowledge, doing really good in our child cares and our preschools and our early education settings. And those settings, they didn't actually ever shut down, right? Because child care had to be up and going so that our police officers and our hospital workers and everybody had child care. And so I'm asking kind of a two-part question. One, is my knowledge correct in that? Are we actually doing really good in our child cares at containing transmission and having good results from families going to child care? And two, if that's true, what can we learn from them, and what can we communicate to families to feel comfortable about that?
So just to summarize, what we found is that the child care setting for the essential worker was a total success. And partly that's based on the fact that very infrequently do children give it to adults.
Okay.
It's adults that give it to children. And in the one outbreak that we've seen in the community that had to do with the child care situation, it was the adult that gave it to the children. So it doesn't mean that the kids don't have it. It just means that they're less likely to transmit it to the adult. So therefore, they've generally done very well. And again, if they're over age 2 and they're wearing a mask, it's no big deal. And what's happened is in the child care facilities, they've been very good about, for instance, wiping off commonly touched surfaces. You know, every hour they're doing that and stuff. And so, again, we've talked about this at other podcasts, but it's the total contact time, the total droplets inhaled. So if you have less of that, even if you're exposed to some, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get it. So again, the program's been a real success. I don't think that will change in the future. We've seen very few children become symptomatic from COVID-19. It's not to say that we've not had a lot of them that have been positive. And the ones that have been positive are usually within families and because of contact with other family members. And they're usually asymptomatic.
Okay.
But we've seen a few of them that have been very sick. In the state of California, I think now there's still less than 50 kids who got really sick from it. So
statewide.
Statewide. Yeah. So it's generally not an issue.
Well, that's nice to hear, and a really nice boost for our preschool teachers that are wiping down those tables 18 times more than they're used to. So, yay. My last question is really around this notion that, well, it might just be a view of mine and a view of those held close to me, but many families I know are very excited that their children are back in school. And even that families that are taking extreme precaution believe in the power of education and that children can be in school. And we're afraid. We're afraid that as we see our numbers trending away, we don't want to, that school might not be an option anymore for us. And simply, I think that comes from constantly reevaluating and assessing and on this journey of constant change. So I'm asking you, is that an option? As we see our numbers trend, is there discussion around closing down schools or not opening schools?
First of all the schools in Pima County as of tomorrow will be open for full in-person education. The ones that had not opened so far totally were in a hybrid model. And they found out that things have worked. And so their parents are totally excited to get their kids back in school. Those schools that had not opened, the reason they had not opened is because it went from 40% of the parents concerned to 60%. The schools were not able to do a totally dual system. There's no way they could have enough teachers to do that. That's why they did what they did. Now, those same parents are clamoring to get their students to in-person education. So, I mean, and they've seen that it works. They've seen that the system works. And again, our goal has been every student, every day. And so we feel comfortable about that. Also, the way the tier system is set up, no matter what tier you're in, once your school is opened, it won't be closed unless you have 25% or more of the individuals in the school being positive. Teachers and children overall. So that anything else is at the discretion of the local public health department. And I can tell you that each instance that we've had when we've been called into the school system from public health, we've intervened very quickly, we've quarantined the individuals, and it stopped. So we're not anticipating that it's going to be an issue. And even in high school, where transmission is much more common, we're finding that the majority of the students are socially distancing, they're wearing their masks, they're washing their hands, they're doing what they're supposed to while at school. When at home, they may socialize with somebody else and not wear their mask and things like that, and they get symptomatic, come to school, we've immediately identified them, tested, and moved them out. And they're learning. And I'd have to tell you, the kids want to be in school so badly and see their friends that even that behavior that's not good behavior is changing.
We all crave social connection, and we all are figuring out how we can get that, right, through school.
That's exactly right.
So the one thing I wanted to dig in, if I haven't already clarified, was I heard you say something about 40 and 60%, and I think that's referring to accumulation of surveys that school districts sent out to parents wanting to know who's comfortable or not comfortable, and we went from about 60% wanting face-to-face school to around 40% wanting, and the schools were not able to fund financially basically two complete programs.
That's correct.
Okay. So really, many of those decisions were not necessarily safety-related decisions, but rather an answer to the community's request or need based on those surveys. It wasn't the public health officer guiding them to not open.
That's correct.
That helps, I think that helps all of us understand a little bit in combination with what you were saying around the purple tier, that unless we reach that 25%, right? With those two pieces of information, I feel like I can breathe easier and not need three different childcare options in my back pocket.
That's a good way to look at it.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Sean Greer, and I've been a Tehama County resident for 20 years. I'm a health and safety specialist with a large corporation in California. I also have a chronic illness that keeps me in bed quite a bit. So I use my spare time to run multiple community groups on Facebook. The most recent of which we started is Tehama Citizens for Freedom, with the primary focus of addressing COVID in our community and the issues that we have around COVID in our community. And I want to note that, you know, I have pretty strong disagreement with a lot of what we're talking about here. I have a strong disagreement to masks. I have a strong disagreement to this. But I think these conversations are critical to finding some balance and moving forward, not just in our community, but in our world, really. So, all right, I'll go ahead with my questions. And my first is, many in our community are concerned about the vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. Could you explain why there are no alternative options?
That's actually very easy to explain. The only reason for the vaccine mandate that I sent out in September was because about 8 weeks ago, we were being told by many healthcare individuals that since they were masking this year, they felt no need to vaccinate for the flu anymore. And that's the farthest thing from the truth, because each thing that we do to treat COVID-19, prevent COVID-19, as I've explained before, is a simple layer. The social distance is one layer. The mask or face shield is another layer. The washing of your hands is another layer. Having the flu vaccine is very helpful, because what's going to happen is, we've talked about this previously, one of the models, and I think this is going to come to pass, one of the models has predicted we'll hit peak season for COVID-19 about the third week or so in November, the maximum number of people in our county. 3 weeks later, we will hit a maximum surge in our hospital. Anything that we can do that keeps our healthcare workers healthy is going to be of utmost importance. And we do know that taking the flu vaccine is very beneficial in that regard. It's not the answer for everybody. It's not perfect, but it adds another layer. We can tell you that in the last year, that the flu vaccine was approximately 40% effective, and in some cases up to 60%. There was information just released from the State Immunization Coalition last week that confirmed that. So we know that it's helpful. We also know that there's been recommendation and a mandate by the UC system, which encumbers 350,000 individuals, including all the UC hospitals, the UC clinics, the university campuses, anybody that's there. In August, the Veterans Service Department on a federal level put out a mandate saying that all healthcare workers needed to vaccinate for influenza. All of these are anticipation of what's going to happen to our workforce for people who develop influenza at the same time that we're trying to deal with COVID-19. So in our community, for years, we've had great adherence to people vaccinating for influenza. We were 96 to 98%. All of a sudden, when people said, we don't need to vaccinate because we're masked, the reason that doesn't work is, and the reason we were successful before, we had a very small percentage that weren't vaccinated. So for them, wearing a mask is fine. And a mask works great as long as you wear it 24 hours a day. It's going to help, you know, you from getting influenza. But who's going to wear a mask 24 hours a day? You're not going to. You've already said that wearing a mask or a face shield is a bother. So we can't change people's behavior, but what we can do is we can give them another tool to be healthy. And so that's why we've mandated the influenza vaccine. Had the same number of people said they were going to get the vaccine as before, we would have felt very comfortable about it. I can tell you that there's a hospital in Shasta County, as of today, the first week that they started doing employed vaccinations for influenza, They now have 100 people declining for the very reasons I discussed. As you probably are aware, Shasta County is rapidly changing in their tier system, and if things don't happen differently, not this coming week, but the following week, they will be in purple. That will be just about the time that we will start seeing influenza. And they are going to have more people unvaccinated for influenza in their hospital system than they've ever had. And it's just a focus for a disaster. And we already have enough problems. We don't need to add to it. And, you know, there are so many options now for the flu vaccine in terms of giving it to people that it's actually very safe. And for people, if they've had reaction to one, there's other ones that are available. And you would pick and choose based on potential problems and how you would then pick. The California Immunization Coalition put out a whole chart last week as if you have this, choose this vaccine. If you have this, choose this vaccine. We're doing that with all the providers. And, you know, I would say that right now in the community, 85 to 90% of the community providers are willing to vaccinate. The ones that you're hearing from is a very small vocal minority. Many of the people who are listed as being opposed to the flu vaccine are not even from our county. So it's very, very interesting.
So you're not concerned about losing staff?
I don't think that's going to happen. And if it does happen, then again, the California Immunization Coalition, their comment, like mine, is our goal as a healthcare provider is first do no harm. And if we know that taking the influenza vaccine is going to help you prevent from spreading influenza within your hospital, then that's something you should do. You know, we mandate people to get their measles vaccine, their mumps vaccine, and they're all doing it. And so this is just another tool. And I think the frustration for people is that those other vaccines are, you know, they have much higher proven efficacy. The flu vaccine isn't always proven efficacy. So that's the bother there. But again, it's adding another layer.
There is a long list of concerns, not just the lack of efficacy, but there are papers that have been issued on repeat flu vaccinations causing you to become less effective over time. And there's also concerns that the flu vaccination may open you up for, expose you to other illnesses such as the coronavirus itself. So I think the concern that I'm understanding and which honestly is a concern for me as we move forward is that there's no out for people who do believe that it is a do harm just by taking the flu vaccine.
So let me answer that. In terms of if you take the flu vaccine, does it predispose you to other illnesses, mm-hmm. other viral illnesses? There was one study that was reported that showed that the CDC has done additional research and that study has never been replicated. And so since you can't replicate that study, then, and this is over the years, that we have to throw that out and say that that was an anomaly. We don't know why that result was, but we haven't been able to reproduce it. And what we're talking about is we're talking about approaching something scientifically. And just as you know, if something doesn't work, you don't keep doing it over and over again. And so I think that's important. In terms of individuals deciding not to stay here and work, you know, that's their choice. And I can tell you that the community as a whole is very supportive of getting the flu vaccine. At our Corning clinic, we had 400 people at our drive-through clinic. That's more than we've ever had. the people are showing up, the communities showing up to get their flu vaccine because they understand what we've said and they're expecting it from their healthcare workers. In fact, people have said, and this was after the recent Board of Supervisors meeting, that if people aren't concerned enough to get their vaccines and protect me, I'm not so sure I want them to provide my care.
I wanted to ask a clarifying question because it confused me a little bit. Rewind back to when you were sharing around the Shasta Hospital. You had seen, I think you said, around 100 folks who were declining the flu vaccine. And you were saying something about how that was a problem for the wave of coronavirus. And I don't understand the connection. I want you to help me understand it.
So the reason for that is that, first of all, you'll have those individuals who may or may not be symptomatic exposing themselves to people that may be taking care of somebody who's COVID-19 positive. That person may not have tested positive yet, but that may be an issue. But secondly, what you're going to see is you're going to see work loss days because those individuals, when they get sick, they're going to be gone and they're supposed to be taking care of our sick patients in the hospital. That's the real concern, is that we're going to decimate our workforce and they will not be there.
Okay.
So the goal is to protect the workforce and also to prevent them from spreading influenza to people who may already be sick with something else.
That was super helpful. Thank you for clarifying. That makes sense.
Hi, I'm Courtney Abbasi. I am the owner of Budge Jollycomb. I was born and raised in Red Bluff. I am pretty young in the community. I'm involved with the Active 2030 Club. And I just have some concerns with how our workforce is right now. And one of my questions is, with the consistent yo-yo of moving up and down in the state's tiered system, how does this truly protect our community? And when it's such a detriment to so many businesses?
The reason the tiers are, and the reason for the time between the tiers, has to do with the infectious period, the contagious period of the virus. That's why we wait 2 to 3 weeks before we move from step to step. If indeed people did what they were supposed to, as we've already talked about, we wouldn't be opening and closing businesses. All the businesses would be open. But when you have people who go out and have social gatherings, they do the right thing at work, but then when they're not at work, they have a social gathering, they become COVID-19 positive, take it back to work, their coworkers become infected and it becomes a problem. So again, if people are doing what they're supposed to, it's not an issue. We've actually seen businesses that have intervened very quickly when they've had somebody that was positive. People have been quarantined. They've re-educated their individuals, and they've been able to move on. And their business is functioning okay. But if you get enough of those, our numbers go up. And what happens is we change tiers. We'll be in the purple tier for at least another week before we can even consider going the other direction. Because we've seen so many cases. We are averaging now about 10 to 12 cases a day. We have one of the highest case rates of any county in the state of California currently, which is not good for us.
I'll add to that when we come back from a break.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Weekly with WIC. Because we believe that an engaged community is a vibrant community. And this episode was brought to you in part by Expect More Tehama and our friends at the Foundation of Northern California. Please be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and even visit our website at expectmoretehama.com. If you have any questions, you can comment or even leave us a DM on Facebook and Instagram of Expect More Tehama.